You're listening to Drinking on the Job, DOTJ. I'm your host, John Coyle. Drinking on the Job is a toast to the culture of food, wine, and all things fermented. We'll be talking with winemakers, musicians, artists, late-night bartenders, scoundrels, and more. It's time to grab a glass before its last call. Chinese tuxedo restaurant graces a magnificent two-story former opera house, adorned with soaring ceilings and elegant columns. Nestled on Doyer Street in the vibrant heart of Chinatown, the ambiance transports visitors to a cinematic backlot, rich with incredible history. Come for the crispy duck salad and dumplings for an unforgettable experience. Chinese Tuxedo is in the house, one of the sexiest, coolest places in New York City. Best kept secret, but till you go there and it's crowded, it is so beautiful. We're going to get into it, but I'm sitting with Ben Gardner today. He was the beverage director for Chinese Tuxedo. He's now at the sister restaurant, Tiger, which is also incredible food. Chinese Tuxedo opened at the end of 2016, the heart of Chinatown. Incredible venue, but before we really do the deep dive on that, we got to figure out how Ben got here.
How did I end up in New York? As you can tell from the accent, definitely not from here.
Yeah.
Honestly, the old-fashioned way. I answered an ad online. And when I was in Sydney, I was working in Sydney for 4 years. And a friend knew that I was looking for some new adventures. Right. And I was in talks with some people in Singapore. I was in talks with some of the crew that I was working with in London again. And someone was like, hey, listen, there's this group. They're looking for someone in to run their venue in New York. I was like, God, why not? I'll take a swing at it.
So how did you end up in Australia? Were you born in Australia?
My father's Australian, so from the West Coast, from Perth. I wasn't born there, but we eventually settled back down in his hometown.
Where's your mom from?
Mom's Singaporean.
Singaporean, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Cool. So you in Australia, did you fall in love with wine while you were in Australia?
Yes, I did. I studied in Australia and did the classic thing where I was working in a restaurant to pay my way through my university, college, and I fell in love with the wine. I fell in love with it way more than my degree, and I never looked back. Most of my father's disgust.
No, it's a tough jump, right? The way people get into this business, I usually tie it back to one bottle of one wine experience. Everyone has one bottle or drink. They're like, I really love this, and it's like, you know, the stained glass with the light coming through it, or bell rings, and they go, how do I get into this?
So what was that bottle?
Yeah, what was that bottle?
I was working at a really nice bistro with a bunch of very similarly aged, like-minded hospitality professionals. A lot of them are running venues in Perth now, but at the time we were young and we didn't know a damn thing, but we were determined to learn from each other and it was so much fun. So we had a beautiful list, and at the end of the week or end of the night, we'd all chip in and buy one of the good bottles on staff discount and open it. Just have a bit of a taste. And the one that honestly changed my mind, I always enjoyed wine, but the one that honestly changed my mind was vintage champagne, because champagne didn't make any sense to me at the time. Like, I didn't understand why anyone would pay so much money for bubbly wine when it tastes like other bubbly wine for the most part. And then we cracked a bottle of Billy Card Nicolas Francois 1996.
Nice.
And I was like, what the fuck is this? This is something else.
I love it.
This is, I don't know. It finally like moved me past the point of, okay, this is wine with bubbles in it, to this is an exceptional wine that just happens to have bubbles in it.
I love Billicard. I've had them on a couple times. It's one of my faves. It's champagne to me can be like jazz. It can sound very like discordant and not together until you really start figuring it out. Yeah. Champagne is complex.
You're right. Like at times, like cacophonous. Like it's hard to pick out the clear note of what you're trying to get through it. Right. Especially like for me, a lot of the time the bubbles are a distraction. Like you want to get to the wine underneath it, and you have to sort of almost fight through them a little bit.
Yeah. A pro tip for anyone listening: champagne, when it goes flat, you can really tell what the wine's about.
Oh my God! The best time I ever had was when this venue in London. I was pouring Krug NV by the glass when the bottle went flat and you had to drink it at the end. Terrible time. Just terrible.
It's just such
so beautiful.
Yeah,
it's like good white Burgundy. Right. So beautiful.
So you end up answering ad. Did you have desire to get to the States? You could go to Singapore. You could probably go
I'd always
anywhere.
Enjoyed New York. I, right. I, the one time, not always. I'd enjoyed New York the one time I'd visited.
Right.
But the opportunity just seemed quite remote to me. They were also asking for a position at the time of GM when I hadn't had any formal experience. I didn't have that job title in my resume. I write a nice shiny cover letter, sent it off into the digital ether, and never ever heard back from them. Some weeks later, I get a follow-up email from Director of Operations, Dan Skinner, and he said, "Did you get my previous email regarding the position that you had applied for?" Furiously searched through my trash inbox, and it turns out that they'd sent me an email like 2 weeks before saying they were interested in me. Oh my God, to this day, I check my trash email every week now. And it just happened from there. We started a conversation, and the whole thing was very, very quick after that. They offered me an opportunity to come over initially more in a, you know, I guess, I don't think I had an official title. I don't know what my official title was, but more in like a support role, get them through, because I landed in Thanksgiving week of 2019.
Right.
To get them through the busy period, and then we'd sort of see where all the bits sort of landed in the new year.
Okay, so at this point, it's already up and running a couple of years.
It is, yeah. It's practically established. 2019, we sort of hit our stride. It's a very busy event season I've landed in, and things are crazy. And I'm hitting New York in winter as well, and it's a massive sea change from Sydney, and I'm excited.
I've been to Sydney. It's such a beautiful city with the Opera House and Coffin Bay Oysters. Great food.
Yeah, amazing scene.
Good wine. Yeah, it's a very cool. So a bit of a culture shock though coming to the States.
Yeah,
and I mean New York in general.
New York in general. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. I would say so. I mean, I'd done through various experiences nearly 9.5 years in the UK previously. So the climate was not a massive change, but like culturally and just getting used to it while on the fly with like a new legal hospitality system, everything tied in was, quite a shock.
Well, congrats, because you talk as fast as a New Yorker or a Bostonian.
Oh, God.
Which is something I used to always get, and I still talk at a good clip. I slow it down purposely.
I'll do my best. I'll
people listen to podcasts. Is it on 1.25? Is it 1.5 speed? What's going on?
A frequent comment of mine. I will endeavor to enunciate.
Well, before we head into the next part, we're going to drink a cocktail.
Yeah.
Cheers, man.
Cheers.
I pick a guest, and we're going to go into like what a cool, incredible, great cocktail program and bar and lounge it is. But we're drinking a little, it's a smoked martini, it meets a Martinez. It's got Isolation Winter Gin, which is a local upstate New York.
Lovely. The
guy's incredible who does this. Method Vermouth, bartender, also in New York. William Hinton Vermouth, a little bit of Empirical Rinse, the Empirical story about their spirits are incredible too, but all done here.
Always a story, John. I appreciate it. And a great cocktail.
Mm. Now, the dive. So, the first time I ever went there, I'm on Doyer Street, and I feel like I'm on the back lot of a movie set. It's a 200-foot street, has an angle in the middle of it.
Correct, yep.
And you feel like you are on a movie set.
Yeah, and has been used several times as a movie set.
I'm sure.
But I would say I agree with you. I think my first experience was definitely getting lost a couple times in Chinatown, and then turning down the street and going, am I in the right place? Is this, you know, exactly if I got lost, if I had taken too many turns and ended up in like 1994 Chinatown, and I'm going to be a bit careful now. But yeah, it's one of the great spectacular bits about the restaurant opening is that sort of like bait and switch almost.
Mm, yeah.
It's like the dropping your expectation to what in God's name, and then you open the doors to the venue and this expansive room sort of like literally opens up before you, below you, and it's like half the job is done in terms of setting expectation when you have a room like that.
100%. The wow factor when you walk in, there's the bar and then this subterranean dining room.
Yeah.
But the history of that place is crazy. I mean, it was an old Chinese opera house, one of the few theaters that one of the only theaters at the time east of California that actually played like Chinese film and opera in the language, and then the gangs. There was a lot of like violent gang wars that happened. We're talking turn of the century.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, not recent.
Beginning of 20th, end of 19th, beginning of 20th century. Yeah. And that's the thing, like the street itself is, before you even get into the venue, is so imbued with history. Yeah. You know, it literally was called the Bloody Angle. It's often considered the most violent in terms of deaths per, I think, like square foot, most violent streets in New York historically, because the gangs did used to use it as an ambush area because of that hook you were talking about in the street. And when the theater opened, I think it was, someone can Google this and tell me I'm wrong, 1894, 1896, it was the first outside of, you're right, outside of San Francisco. Mm. It was a dedicated Chinese theater and or opera house. It operated as both at the time. And it was, for the most part, neutral ground for the Tongs, for the gangs in the area. So it was considered a spot where you could sort of come in, and it was a bit more neutral, and there was no particular threat to you if you were coming in to watch a show.
Right.
And that all sort of changed in 1905. Yeah. It's the famous incident.
I thought, that was an interesting fact that one of the gangs liked to use hatchets as their weapon of choice, and that's where the word hatchet man came from.
I believe that, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I'm just so enthralled with the history of there. It's just incredible.
Honestly, I'm surprised, because they made a quite fun TV series about the San Francisco Tong gangs, but I'm waiting for the New York one to come around. Doy Street will feature prominently, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Asian versions of Gangs of New York, right?
Very
with
much.
Like the Five Points and the Dead Rabbit Gang and all that kind of stuff, right?
Very much. It's a history that, like, honestly, that stretches all the way into the 1990s as well in terms of its extension, but obviously, like, nowhere near as dramatic as the turn of the century, but still, like, part of a long, long part of New York's history as well, which is kind of like terrifying and fun.
Right. So let's get into the gentleman that decided that with this incredible vision to, like, restore this place to its original grandeur in the history. I mean, I was reading that they actually found some original menus. But what was that construction like? Because you had to unearth. There's supposedly secret tunnels. I don't know if they're still in existence, but, like, shed some light on that.
A little bit of everything. So Chinese Tuxedo exists now. So the name as well was even a pre-existing name. That was Chinatown's first fine diner, and it was actually at 2 Doyer Street. So it was up at the north end of Doyer Street originally, and we reappropriated the name for the venue. Mm-hmm. And the space itself, that was, I guess, the bigger project. So Jeff Lamb and the Lamb family, in association with Eddie Buckingham, which is that Australian connection, took over the space in 2016 and opened at the end of 2016. But a lot of the work at the time was, as you were sort of saying, like the uncovering of the space again. And it's really fun to talk to Jeff because his company does the full build outs and construction.
Okay.
And it's so good when you get to, like, tap him and just have him tell these stories of, like, what it was like in 2016, like, digging up this and excavating this space, because it had been through so many incarnations since then. After the Chinese Theater, it was a mission for a while. And then when the guys took it over in 2016, it had been a very kind of, like, nondescript generic shopping center. They'd plastered up all the facades.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was literally stripping it back to the original wall. So Jeff tells these stories because you've been to the space, but there are these
gorgeous
three original pillars which run through the dining room, like in the most inconvenient spaces, like the most inconvenient spots in the dining room, which is why you have to know the original, because they cut through a booth, they cut through a staircase.
Yeah, okay.
The guys just decided to leave them. But when they took the space over, Jeff tells me it was all covered in like plaster. They plastered them up. So he was and his crew were just assuming they were supporting pillars and were chipping back at them and realized that there were actually original supporting pillars in there. The original supporting pillars had been gilded in gold leaf. They were chipping this back in a demo spot, and gold leaf was floating around
the room.
Oh, my
God.
Can you even imagine this space?
Oh, my God.
With this ancient, beautiful history where they paired the walls back. The back wall is the original wall. A lot of it is, like, just taking it back to the original wall spacing. And I can only imagine this dust-covered room with specks of gold leaf just floating through the air.
Yeah.
Must have been something spectacular.
That was pretty cool. So are there tunnels, or did they find existing tunnels that you read about historically?
Two existing tunnels in the venue that connect the venue to what would have been the old smuggling tunnels that apparently run all the way up and down and along Canal Street and connect the whole way. So if you go down to the cocktail lounge downstairs, Peachy's, and go to the booth area, you can see one of the tunnels that that Jeff and his crew had to cinder block up when they first took the space. So apparently, like, it went further deep and they had to clean it out and cover the cinder block. And strangely, the other one, just because of how the restaurant ended up being, is back of house. So you'll never get to see it probably, but in the back of house, in the back of the kitchen, there is another cinder blocked up tunnel, which would have been two of the original smuggling tunnels.
So they were, like, smuggling and escape routes probably, right?
I believe, yeah.
That's crazy. Did they unearth any, like, really, like interesting stuff, or bones, bodies, weapons?
I can't pry it out of Jeff. Jeff tells me that they found some pretty funky stuff down there, but he won't give me details on it. Maybe I'll twist his arm and we can get me back for the part two of this.
All right, that would be totally awesome. So tell me, like, I'd love to paint a picture of the vibe and the feel. There are a few places in New York City that I think it has to do with tectonic plates. There's an ambiance there. It's the street, and then you walk in and it's beautiful. and it's subterranean. And there are places like Keen's that I love, Il Buco that I love, that just have something you just can't get anywhere else in the city. And bravo for not doing like fusion food. It's great Cantonese food, which we'll talk about in a bit. Yeah. But the space, right?
Listen, I was literally thinking about this on the way in as well, like how to explain it. It is a really tough one because it's not something you can manufacture. Like it kind of has to, I mean, you can manufacture it by sheer time and a bit of chance and, you know, the right bits of history falling into place. But I think for us as well, it was also adopting this space that had so much history already. Like, yeah. I think about it like when you're going to like a really great stadium or a church or an art gallery or something, like many, many people have passed through the space or into the space with this sense of reverence, and somehow it imbues the space with it. Like it's always there already. And I think just because of the nature of it being a theater and having so many people through it and this like amazing history, there's a sense of like something of reverence already built into the space before you even if it's your first time going there, even if you don't know, even if you don't have a set expectation of what it is, like it's hard to ignore that sense when you step into it. And I think that's a rare and hard thing.
Yeah, so I think you can't recreate it. I think that's the problem with a lot of restaurants. Or like, I can't think of a more shining example. You know, I just had Monk McGinn's on, and like when you go to a real Irish pub, you can kind of feel it, right?
Yeah.
And then when you go to some bullshit fake Irish pub, you can feel that too. There's just, but the historical sense that you get when you're in that space. Anyone that I know that has been there, the first thing is like, oh my God, I love that space. Or you know. Madison, our cocktail person, who deliciously made this cocktail for us.
Thanks, Madison.
Yeah. Anyone who's been in there, the wow factor is incredible. So good.
I agree. And it's something about this, everything, the awkwardness of it. It's not a regular shape. It's not a regular anything. It's like you almost have to discover all these little spaces in it. Even downstairs when you go into Peaches, like you have to discover all these nooks and crannies. And it feels, it's at one point like this, like massive and reverential. And at one point, especially for regulars, weirdly personal for them too. They have their favorite little corners and nooks and everything. And
it's a big place. How many does it hold seat wise?
Up. So Johnny's Tuxedo, if you were to fill out everything at max, I think it's about 108, 112 if you were to sort of push everything through.
I want people to know because they're going to want to now go there.
Yeah.
And I want to let them know it's not 30 seats.
It's not 30 seats.
Still hard to get the reservation.
It's still hard to get the reservation.
Yes.
Listen, and that's something that the guys and we all work towards as well. And I think that like this beautiful confluence, especially post-pandemic, that sort of came about when people wanted to celebrate and they wanted these special occasion spots. And it sort of began to sort of fill this need and this idea for people in a really fantastic way. And we were fortunate. I mean, we put out a good product. Obviously, you've been there and everything, but you know what restaurants are like. I'm sure you've interviewed as many people who no longer work in restaurants when they used to as they did then. It's a tough industry. And you have to bank on a lot of things to make it happen, as well as just your own consistency and quality. And where we've got it to now, where the guys have got it to now, it's busy, it's energetic. It for me encapsulates this vibe of and this idea of what you imagine like live theater would be, like the energetic night.
Yeah, it does have a theater feel to it. Yeah. Like we were just discussing, there's an energy there that, you know, it's just very special. I don't know anyone who's ever walked in doesn't speak highly of like the vibe and feel, and they always just the same words like, oh, it's so cool, it's so beautiful, it's so and that's what that place is so special, and people now will be fighting to get in. But we should talk a little bit about the food. I've had the 5-spice pork dumplings. They just kind of melt.
Fantastic. I mean,
in your mouth, the crispy eggplant, the roasted duck salad.
I'm
salivating just talking about this. What are some of your favorites, and what are some of your favorite food and wine, food and cocktail, food and pairings?
Good. Fair to say that it's definitely a modern take on Cantonese food. It's from southern China, is where Jeff and the Lam family are from. So it's sort of played into their love of their own banqueting style of cuisine, and as well as like very New York kind of like energy to it as well. So there are classic ideas in there, but it's very modern in flavors, like big, bold, and punchy. So that informs like the wine list and the wine pairing as well. Like we wrote down this idea once of like what a Chinese tuxedo wine is, and it's you know, it leans towards New World because it's bold and it's expressive, and it wears its heart on its sleeve, and it's like it's, you need these almost sort of like fruit forward big punchy flavors to keep up with the sauces and the spice and the everything that you're going to find. You're going to find in these dishes. So for me as well, like it's like a rogues gallery in my head of best dishes. We did an amazing like crab dish, like a black pepper crab dish once. And these things come and go and you wish they'd stay forever, but they have to. The duck salad you're talking about, but then also a crispy duck that we did later as well. Oh my God, John, stop it. We're going for dinner after this.
My favorite pairing, anything with crab, is always Riesling.
Yeah, I think fantastic. Riesling with crab.
Riesling with crab is my favorite. Like, it's, yeah. It's,
aromatic whites in general, like Alsatian and white blends and Austrian whites, fantastic with our food as well. Mm. And white's often overlooked because people coming to celebrate want to sort of hit a red wine kind of bent. But definitely a lot of our food, especially with the spice, leans itself towards a fantastic, like German Riesling or Austrian Gruner or a Silvaner blend or something like that, where you just get these like beautiful aromatic flavors that are all going to get lifted by the food and the heat as well.
And not kill you. To match the spice.
Yeah. And to match the spice a little bit as well and to find that level on it.
But I looked at the wine, there's nice, there's a great Pinot, Gamay, Fleury, things like that just lend itself to bold and juicy and fruity, which you need with that kind of spice, right?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, to whatever extent we follow the trends as well, we found like certain trends have translated well for the food as well, like the interest in chilled reds. Yeah. We sort of realized that for us, that's kind of like a year-long thing that makes a lot of logical sense when people want to still do red with the food, but having that chill in it can sort of like be a nice like foil to a bit of to some of the richer dishes as well. So sort of making a permanent chilled red section. Even surprisingly orange wines, like the right kind of like skin contact wines, have been like fantastic with it.
I was going to say, I'm a big orange, even with sushi, the extra texture you get, but the orange, but there's always abundant fruit, which is nice.
Look, because you talk about that classic clash, which is tannins and chili, tannins and spice.
Yeah.
I feel like it's abated a little bit if the tannins are coming from grape skin rather than oak. Yeah. And if the tannins are coming from like a white grape rather than a red grape. Like it's just less of a coarse kind of clash. And so having like these more tannic white wines is actually a really nice way to play sort of both ends of the spectrum with the food match as well. So that's been like a massive success for us across the group actually. And being awake to that has sort of opened up a lot more pairings, matchings, and just sort of generally like excited wine experiences for people too. Right.
Do you have some like one of your favorite moments there, either celebrity wise or food pairing or a night that was just magical? I'm sure there's got to be quite a bit, and I mean there's always a fight at the door to get in. But like any like VIPs who are just I gotta have dinner and you have to accommodate.
I'm not a drop. I'm so bad. Okay, I'm so bad. But honestly, the biggest occasion day for us is always Lunar New Year, where we open all the way through and we do lunch. Rolling straight into dinner, incorporate the lion dances, incorporate a lot of like cultural activities.
Oh, wow.
For us, like it's my favorite day there. It's my favorite day in Chinese Tuxedo because it sort of transforms us from what is like a really great New York restaurant to actually something which we get to interact with the cultural aspect of what we are a little bit and our location. It's easy for us, I guess, to get distracted from that. And Jeff and the guys will be the first to tell you there were a lot of issues at the beginning because Chinatown didn't feel like we fit in in Chinatown, where we were interlopers and outsiders. And and for me, Lunar New Year is one of these opportunities where we get to really engage with our community a bit more and just say, hey, like we are not just a good New York restaurant, we're a Chinatown restaurant and we're damn proud to be in this address, in this location, and it means something.
And to really embrace the history of that space, which you've guys done. So I'm sure that has appeased many people. I mean, because, you know, it could have very easily been a fucking pizza place.
Could well have been. That's,
right?
I mean,
because of the space and how beautiful it is. I mean, kind of blessed that it stayed true to its the cuisine.
I think that's definitely helped.
Well, cool. Also, you know, we got to mention the sister restaurant. Tiger Restaurant as well.
We could do a whole other podcast on that.
I know.
Opening a restaurant during the pandemic in the heart of Lord Almighty.
I think it might have been one of the last times I saw you. We were sitting outside tasting.
We were. Fun times. I mean, honestly, that's a whole other kettle. Like I said, a whole other story as well. We'd signed this lease before the pandemic hit, before the shutdown hit, and had to bite the bullet and go, right, we're powering through with this. Opened fully outdoors, like just before winter, September in 2020. And made a hell of a go of it. I think helped by the fact that no one else was doing anything that ridiculous at the time.
Yeah. I for me, I've, um, I I'll be honest, I have PTSD from those fucking sheds. I will not sit outside. Even in the summertime, so you have the table outside, I'm like, no! Because I just get this flashback of like sitting outside at restaurants, like
yeah,
most of my favorite restaurants, and the food would get cold in 3 minutes, and my feet would be freezing, and then the check comes, and it's still really expensive, and I want to support the restaurants, but everything just sucked. And so I'm like, when there's always indoor, outdoor, I will never check outdoor again for a long time.
I don't think you're the only one. We went to extraordinary lengths to keep those booth warm, like ridiculous. Jeff was building heaters into the seats. Yeah. We were doing dropped heaters. We were doing as enclosed that we could legally enclose. The history of Tiger is like this, ever-changing like creature that like always seems to be reacting to like this newest wave of pandemic rules and laws. And it's the great challenge with that venue has been trying to holding the core of it and the core of its identity steady while we navigate this endless like changes around, which it's a kind of good like barometer, I guess, for like how dining has been since 2020 in terms of like how it's had to react and how it's changed and the challenges for it, which I'm sure a lot of venues have faced.
A lot of people didn't survive.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Went under and some great landlords gave their tenants, breaks in rent that saved them. And I've had a few of them on, and that's kind of nice to hear. But I'm happy that we're kind of back and business is booming again. So we're at the part of the show where I said, Ben, you've done such an amazing job, opening and being relevant and keeping the Chinese history alive for Chinese Tuxedo and the Sister of Saint Tiger. And God says, Ben, I'm going to give you a gift. You, sir, are going to know the last day that you'll be on the planet, so you can pick your meal, your drink, and what piece of music that you'll be floating off to.
You forewarned me, and I still think you're a cruel man for asking me these questions, John. I've been in a sentimental mood recently, so I'm actually going to say, after visiting my mother's homeland recently and realizing how much I missed Singapore, I'm sitting in a hawker center in Singapore, and I'm eating a really, really good bowl of laksa. And maybe there's like a little mee siam on the side as well. There's a little sort of noodle dish as well in addition. God forbid my brother is also there, and we're sharing a couple of freshly pressed glasses of sugarcane juice. So there's my sentimental answer. Wow. That said, maybe on the side there's a little to-go cup that's filled with Heyman Lowenstein's Rothley First Lager Riesling, just to help the laksa go down. Yeah. But honestly, I'm there for the sugarcane juice.
I've never had sugarcane juice.
Oh my God, it's the best.
Is it alcoholic?
No, they just take the canes and pass it through several times through a set of like grinding teeth, and the juice just comes out fresh.
Oh my God.
Straight over ice. If you ask the uncle nicely, he'll put a squeeze of lime in for you or a squeeze of lemon in for you. Probably more likely calamansi.
That sounds great.
And it's just like a served frosty in a mug, almost like it's a beer.
Oh my God, it's that just, sounds so good.
It's something nostalgic and refreshing at the same time. And what's playing? I don't know, because I forgot about that bit. The tinny sound system in the hawker center, which isn't true. There's never a sound system in the hawker center. But the tinny sound system in the hawker center is playing J.J. Cale's album Troubadour on repeat for no good reason. Someone's got the CD player stuck and it's just going over and over.
All right. And is this place like a food place like that you're eating at?
It's called a generic food court. It's any hawker center on the street. It's above a car park in the center of town. It's 411 around the corner in Aokang where my family lives. It's down on Sims Avenue. There's a million of them everywhere. It doesn't matter. It's just about being there.
Right, so I want people to go check out Chinese Tuxedo and Tiger.
Please.
So like, how do they find you? Instagram?
Find us on Instagram, find us online, available through Resy. Drop in and say hi. Yeah. You can name drop me. It doesn't count for anything, but it's worth a shot.
Chinese Tuxedo. And Tiger is spelled
T-Y-G-E-R. The Tiger.
Okay, cool. So check them out on Instagram. I will close with saying the wow factor on this place going in and the meal and the ambience and the history we talked about. It's a very special experience. Treat yourself, treat your loved ones. Thanks for being on, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me, John. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to check us out at dotjpodcast.com. Until then, I'll see you at the bar.